Hello, and welcome to A History of Japan.
Season 10, Episode 12, The Imjin War, Part 2, Hideyoshi's Crusade. By 1590, Toyotomi Hideyoshi was the unchallenged ruler of Japan. Soon after the fall of Odawara, he relocated to a temporary residence on northern Kyushu in a city called Nagoya, not to be confused with the Nagoya in Owari Province, which we've discussed in previous episodes. From the Kyushu city of Nagoya, Hideyoshi would direct the proceedings of the invasion from afar, especially coordinating the logistics of supply lines and reinforcement. The failure of the Korean elite to prepare for what, in hindsight, were obvious signs that the peninsula was about to be invaded is largely considered to be one of the worst failures of military intelligence in world history. However, I think they can be somewhat forgiven for their short-sighted negligence given Japan's own contemporary history. Japan and Korea's primary connection during this period was through trade with Kyushu. While news of the actions of Oda Nobunaga may have gradually trickled over to the western island, it wasn't until the late 1580s that unification really came to Kyushu through Hideyoshi's campaign. Sengoku Jidai had lasted for almost 100 years, but even before the Onin War, Kyushu had remained outside of the Ashikaga shogunate's direct control. It's easy to see how the scholar officials of the Chosun Kingdom were skeptical to believe that their eastern neighbor, a patchwork, balkanized nation composed of competing petty quasi-states, was even capable of unifying, much less of directly threatening their own sovereignty. In the previous episode, we briefly discussed the state of the Korean land army. The state philosophy/religion which governed the Joseon dynasty's affairs was a particularly moralistic brand of Neo-Confucianism. Under this ideology, only wise, charismatic scholars were suitable as leaders of any given government office, and this included the military. However, while other nations would develop things like war colleges to help them with specialized knowledge for military leadership, the Joseon Kingdom treated its army like any other branch of the government. There was a specialized military version of the civil service exam, but this was largely a demonstration of martial prowess and involved demonstrating archery, horsemanship, and other forms of traditional fighting. Their tactics were largely influenced by the occasional skirmish with Jurchen raiders who crossed their northern borders, conflicts which depended on competent cavalry. In terms of weaponry, the infantry of the Joseon armies primarily used spears, swords, bows, and horses. Although they had received their share of Portuguese and other European traders from abroad, personal firearms like the arquebuse never caught on the way they had in Japan. They were seen as a curiosity, and the Joseon government did not yet realize their tactical and strategic potential on the battlefield. However, while the land armies of Korea did not heavily utilize gunpowder weaponry, their navy went absolutely all in on heavy cannonry for their ships for the purposes of fighting pirates. While the naval forces suffered from some minor deficits among their leadership, the sailors were competent enough to make up for shortcomings in the command structure, and the admirals of the navy deserve credit for being quick studies in the arena of naval warfare. The Korean Navy itself was composed largely of two types of warships, and we will begin with the by far more common of the two, the Panogsun. A double-masted ship with a U-shaped hull and a flat keel, the Panogsun was ideal for navigating the coastal waters around the Korean peninsula. Its maneuverability and relative speed more than outmatched the unwieldy Atakebune ships used by the Japanese invaders. The Atakebune were basically transport ships for samurai and other troops, and the tendency of Japanese captains to favor grappling and boarding tactics over cannon bombardment meant that the Korean Navy would frequently prevail even in battles where they were grossly outnumbered. This brings us to the second major warship type deployed by the Korean Navy, a double-masted ship with a funny name but a devastating presence on the battlefront. The deck was covered by overlapping iron plates, possibly adorned with spikes, and enclosed with thick protective walls. The wooden hull was reinforced with layers of iron plates, and on its bow, or front, was the figurehead of a dragon. Like the Panoksan, it was flat-bottomed, which made maneuverability in shallow waters a breeze. Armed with long-ranged cannon and other heavy weaponry, it was truly a terror of the Korean coast. It was called the Turtle Ship. The earliest known mention of turtle ships is from 1413, but by the late 1500s the ship had fallen out of use because it wasn't needed, and such vessels were expensive to build and maintain given the iron needed to make them impregnable. Seeing that the coming war with Japan seemed inevitable, in 1591 Admiral Yi Sun-shin pressed for new turtle ships to be constructed to help the Navy meet this impending existential threat. Yi Sun-shin's career had a slow start. While taking the military civil service examination in the 1570s, he broke his leg during the cavalry portion of the test. He finally passed in 1576, but by this time he was 32 years old, which made him the oldest among his fellow junior officers in the Northern Frontier Army stationed near the border with Manchuria. During that time, small-scale Jurchen raids were increasing in frequency, and Yi Sun-shin gained practical military experience by fighting the bands of raiders. In 1583, he made a name for himself by luring one such band of raiders into a trap and executing their leader. However, his fame was short-lived and his career put on hold when jealous superiors accused him of desertion and had him imprisoned and tortured. In spite of his early difficulties in passing the service exam, Yi Sun-shin was born into a noble family and was thus subject to these sorts of shenanigans with which the noble families competed against one another. Years later, Yi Sun-shin may have smiled upon hearing the news that General Yi Yi, the man who had arranged for his imprisonment and torture, was forced to flee the battlefield at the Battle of Songju, discarding his armor and eventually abandoning his exhausted horse as he fled. As part of his punishment, Yi Sun-shin was stripped of his rank. He was allowed to rejoin the army as an enlisted soldier, though, and soon climbed up the ranks through his own efforts. In fact, the rapid-fire promotions enjoyed by Yi Sun-shin indicate to me that the military higher command probably recognized that his reputation had been unjustly besmirched by General Yi Yi. By 1591, he had been made an admiral in the Left Chawla Naval District. This was when he began constructing the new and improved turtle ships, which he would bring to bear against the Japanese after they invaded. The first such engagement took place near the town of Sancheon, located on the central southern Korean coast between two large cliffs. Spotting a Japanese fleet of 13 ships anchored near the cliffs, Admiral Yi Sun-shin wanted to engage them but was wary of the potential threat from arquebusiers firing onto the decks of his ships from the cliffs. He brought his fleet, 25 Panoksan and one turtle ship, into the bay as near to the Japanese position as he dared, then ordered them to turn and make for open waters. This appeared to the Japanese to be a retreat, and they soon boarded their ships and quickly pursued. In fact, this was precisely what Admiral Yi Sun-shin wanted. The Japanese pursuit lasted until evening, and when they finally overtook the Korean fleet, it was very dark. The admiral ordered his ships to fan out into a U-shaped formation, and they proceeded to outmaneuver the Japanese fleet while bombarding them with cannon fire as well as chongtong, a specialty cannon which launched massive iron arrows which were around 9 feet long, that's 2.7 meters, and had an average effective range of 1.4 kilometers, or around 9-tenths of a mile. These punctured the hulls of the Japanese ships and sank them fairly handily. After several hours of fighting, all 13 ships that composed the enemy fleet were sunk. During the course of the battle, one of the Japanese warships had come close enough for the arquebusiers on board to fire onto the admiral's ship itself. A bullet struck his arm, but upon further inspection, it barely broke the skin. Likely the great distance the payload had traveled reduced its lethality. Although their fleet had been reduced to sunken wrecks, some of the Japanese troops managed to swim to shore. They rushed to tell their commanders on land about the incident, and this may have been the first time that the Japanese leaders worried about whether their seaborne supply line would hold up against a concerted effort by the apparently superior Korean Navy. Back in Nagoya on Kyushu, Hideyoshi was furious at the reports he was receiving that dared imply superiority of the Koreans in any capacity. He also may have been regretting his decision to expel the Jesuit missionaries from Japan's shores, as that decision had caused the offer of two state-of-the-art Portuguese warships to be rescinded. He ordered an increase in the size of the Japanese fleet, bringing the total number of the invading vessels to 1,700 in an attempt to overwhelm the enemy navy by sheer numbers. Considering that these ships still possess the same weaknesses as their predecessors, this seems like a strategy more suited to Futurama's Zap Brannigan than the typically clever and far-seeing Hideyoshi. In fact, Hideyoshi's actual motivations for prosecuting this war are still the subject of rigorous academic debate. As I did with Akechi Mitsuhide, I will try and summarize the most likely reasons he had for invading Korea and allegedly pushing onward to conquer Ming China. Although he had cobbled together a rough consensus of daimyo across the nation of Japan into submission, he had good reasons to be worried that this unification might not last. In spite of his considerable successes on the battlefield and in the political arena, his origins as a commoner still made him ineligible to become the shogun himself. This brings another long-standing question about Hideyoshi's suzerainty regarding why he didn't have a false genealogy forged which would prove that he was descended from the Minamoto. Such fake genealogies were common, and the man who will seize power at the end of this season certainly had no qualms about such dishonesty. The primary difference between them was that Hideyoshi's successor was part of a long-established samurai clan, while Hideyoshi himself was undeniably the child of common peasants. He may have felt that such a forgery would be crossing the line somehow, at least in the eyes of his powerful subordinates. Regarding Korea, the largest motivating factor was probably finding a way to allow the samurai to continue acting as warriors during a time of national peace. There's an old saying in the United States, buy land, because God's not making any more of it. The Korean Peninsula was a vast landmass with a fertile agrarian economy and a weak land army. By invading the Joseon Kingdom, Hideyoshi was expanding the land available to dole out as rewards for compliant daimyos after the conquest was complete. It's not entirely incorrect to compare Toyotomi Hideyoshi to Napoleon Bonaparte. Both became the ruler of their respective nations through conquest, both seemed to possess a determination to always be at war, and both would eventually overstretch their supply lines to the detriment of their soldiers. Some latter-day historians have tried to make a case that this conquest was the result of dementia or some other megalomania on the part of Hideyoshi. While this is possible, I tend to think this lets Hideyoshi off the hook for the expedition's eventual failure. While he often referred to the impending conquest of China as an irresistible goal, some modern historians believe that his war with the Ming Dynasty was really just a smokescreen to give his invasion of Korea a just cause, and that the Korean Peninsula was his actual objective all along. It is notable that not every daimyo in the nation joined with the invasion of Joseon, nor were they all invited to. Tokugawa Ieyasu, now ensconced in Kanto, where he was establishing his authority and adjusting his strategies for governance, was noticeably left out of the invasion, and I think it likely that Hideyoshi wanted to keep him isolated at the far end of the country, where he couldn't win battlefield glory and possibly attract some of Hideyoshi's own retainers to his banner. That being said, Ieyasu did send some contingents of troops as a token force to support the Taiko, while remaining in Kanto to manage his own affairs. The actual organization of the invasion's logistical backend is an impressive feat for its day and age. Gold and silver coins were minted to pay for the expedition, and enough provisions for almost 500,000 troops were secured. The first wave of Japanese troops would have 7 divisions and were assembled on Tsushima Island, where they embarked for Korea. The largest single division by far was that belonging to Mori Terumoto, at an impressive 30,000 warriors. Kato Kiyomasa and Shimazu Yoshihiro each brought 10,000, followed by Konishi Yukinaga's contingent of 7,000. Combined with 75,000 troops sent from absentee daimyos like Ieyasu, the total number of the first wave was around 225,000. Within 2 months, both Hansong, which is modern-day Seoul, and Pyongyang were in the hands of the Japanese army. While the Chosun naval victory at Sanchon was impressive, this conflict was destined to stretch on for many years and make life extremely difficult for the Korean population. In the previous episode, I recounted how the records from the Siege of Busan indicated that while there were only 600 soldiers in the city, over 8,000 were killed and just 200 taken prisoner. The warriors who were prosecuting this war on the ground, both samurai and ashigaru, were not concerned with minimizing civilian casualties, and indeed were roughly incentivized to kill as many Koreans as possible, whether they were combatants or not. Each head earned a reward from their daimyo, so the samurai had a vested interest in taking heads. While the rank-and-file samurai were competing against one another for heads, their daimyo were competing against one another for bigger rewards. This led occasionally to infighting and a lack of cohesion among the overall Japanese army in Korea, and the men chosen to lead the 1st and 2nd divisions of the first wave of the invasion force were strikingly different. Leading the 1st division of over 18,000 was Konishi Yukinaga, who was common-born like Hideyoshi and had attained samurai rank through bold service to the Taiko. He converted to Roman Catholicism in 1583, and his Christian name was Agostinho. Leading the 2nd division was a samurai named Kato Kiyomasa, who practiced a nationalistic brand of Nichiren Buddhism and was known as an expert castle builder. The leader of the 1st division, Konishi Yukinaga, actually didn't like the idea of involving Japan in foreign wars. He had accepted his post out of loyalty to Hideyoshi, and he spurred the early rapid advance of the Japanese army in hopes of capturing King Sanjo himself, forcing the sovereign's submission, and bringing the conflict quickly to an end. He had previously traveled to the Philippines and met with the Spanish leaders there in a delegation whose primary interest was the joint conquest and assimilation of China. While you, fair listener, are probably familiar with the Spanish conquest of Mexico and South America, at least broadly, you may be surprised to hear that none other than Hernán Cortés himself suggested using newly established bases on the American West Coast, as well as Spanish colonial holdings like the Philippines, as forward bases in a grand conquest of China itself. The ensuing project was known as La Empresa de China in Spanish, which means the China Enterprise. If this is the first you have ever heard of such a plan, you are not alone. It is only through researching this specific episode that any of this popped onto my radar. La Empresa de China, largely pushed by Spanish Jesuits, was abandoned in 1588 when the Spanish Armada was utterly annihilated during their attempted invasion of England in opposition to Queen Elizabeth I. During his travels, Konishi Yukinaga gained a more accurate assessment of the size and capabilities of Ming China, and it was precisely because he understood how difficult it would be to prevail against the Chinese that he was trying so desperately to capture the Korean sovereign and give this invasion a quick resolution. The Korean royal family managed to stay one step ahead of the invading Japanese horde, avoiding capture at Hansong and Pyongyang, and finally taking shelter in the fortified city of Yongbyon in the far north. Shortly after the seizure of Hansong and before the siege of Pyongyang, the remaining soldiers defending Korea were rallied under the banner of Kim Myung-won, a scholar official who opted for military command when the invasion began. The remainder of the Chosun Land Army gathered on the northern bank of the Injin River, where they planned to make a stand against the Japanese invaders and halt their northern advance. The number of Korean defenders was probably around 13,000, but these were composed in part of different regional commanders with their own troops. Although this army was largely comprised of professional soldiers, it lacked a clear chain of command. The Japanese armies that came to oppose them numbered in total around 20,000, nearly twice their own number. However, the defenders had a considerable advantage due to the terrain. There was only one stretch of the river that was crossable, and so they deployed themselves near enough to loose arrows into anyone attempting to ford the Imjin River. The Japanese commanders perceived this potential death trap well enough and waited, encamped on the far side of the river, for 10 days. After their week and a half long standoff, the Japanese attackers decided to attempt a maneuver that was often risky, but, when it worked, was incredibly effective. They struck camp and withdrew to the south in full sight of the defenders on the northern bank. The various patchwork regional armies and factions composing the defending force were stunned by this apparent retreat, and many of the inexperienced commanders urged pursuit. Kim Myung-won, to his credit, believed that this withdrawal was a ruse and argued for the army to remain in its well-defended position. However, because it was not clear who was in charge and authorized to give orders, many of the individual segments of the Chosun army chose to advance regardless. Some divisions, which contained veterans of battles against Jurchen raiders, allegedly warned their commanding officers that this was a likely trap and were executed for cowardice as a result. The remnant of the official Chosun army, one division after another, charged through the river after the fleeing enemy. It wasn't long after their crossing that Japanese arquebusiers, hiding in the underbrush, opened fire in repeated volleys that devastated the Korean troops. As the survivors attempted to flee back across the river, Japanese soldiers with spears and swords charged and cut them down as they tried to swim back to safety. Somewhere around 10,000 of the initial 13,000 were killed, along with most of the commanding officers. Kim Myung-won fled north and continued serving King Sonjo throughout the course of the war. After the collapse of the last regular Korean defenders at the Battle of Imjin River in early July of 1592, the land of the entire peninsula was practically up for grabs by the Japanese invaders. Pyongyang was seized soon afterward, and in spite of a few spirited naval victories by Korean admirals, there was no sign that this invasion was even slowing down, much less being repulsed. As a side note, this conflict is broadly referred to as the Imjin War because the Korean era name was Imjin. The entire war was not named after the disaster at the Imjin River. In August, less than 3 months after the initial invasion, hope finally arrived in the form of two armies sent from the Ming Dynasty. Together, these numbered around 2,000 initially, but they were soon buoyed by Korean volunteers, including the king's personal guard, who swelled the count to between 3,000 and 6,000. The unimpressive numbers in this force, which from the Chinese side was composed mostly of mercenaries, indicate that Ming China was still not taking this invasion seriously. Nevertheless, numbers alone do not confer victory, and in mid-August of 1592, the combined Ming-Korean army marched out of Weijia, a fortified city very close to the border of China, where King Sanjo had taken up residence. Their target was Pyongyang, where Konishi Yukinaga had been trying to lay the necessary logistical groundwork for further northern incursions, but was stalled by supply shortages. Already, the Korean Navy was gaining ground in the fight for the peninsula, sinking Japanese battleships and freighters alike, and causing a pinch in the supply chain. The Chinese-Korean army arrived at Pyongyang without the Japanese having received any forewarning of their approach. The defenders of the city's outskirts panicked at the sight of an approaching army and fled to the inner part of the city, allowing the Ming Joseon army to seize one of the gatehouses along the city's northern wall. As the attackers filed in, however, the Japanese defenders realized they were comparatively small in number and approached their positions with a wide front as they prepared to respond. The Chinese cavalry in particular had a rough time in the ensuing Battle of Pyongyang, as the narrow streets provided no protection from the bullets of arquebusiers and were difficult to maneuver through. One of the Ming commanders was killed in the melee, and the other only narrowly escaped with his life. The rest of the army was killed nearly to a man as they were encircled and slaughtered. The surviving Ming commander assured King Sanjo that he had merely executed a strategic retreat and was going back to China to raise more troops to assist in the effort. After he crossed the border, he wrote an account of the battle to Emperor Wanli, blaming the defeat on the Korean troops. The defeat of this army, small though it was, caused a panic in the Ming court. It was believed that the Japanese were naturally inferior to the Chinese troops, both in tactics and weaponry, and that even a small Ming force could make short work of them. The destruction of practically their entire army woke them up to the fact that the Japanese were a real threat, not only to their heartland, but to their tributary state of the Chosun Kingdom. In October, just a few weeks after the humiliating defeat at Pyongyang, Emperor Wanli wrote to King Sanjo assuring him that the Ming Dynasty was organizing a massive relief army to drive the Japanese invaders into the sea. While the King of Chosun no doubt rejoiced at this news, the Chinese support would eventually turn into a careful what you wish for kind of situation. Next time, we will continue our discussion of the Imjin War as fresh Ming troops arrived in 1593 to take on the Daimyo, who were beginning to worry about the durability of their sea-based supply line.
Until then, thank you for listening. If you would like access to exclusive bonus episodes, as well as ad-free versions of the regular episodes, please consider supporting this podcast at patreon.com/ahistoryofjapan.